Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.
Okay, time to catch up again with our Deputy Prime Minister, our Minister of Foreign Affairs, the leader of New Zealand First. And boy, quite a few discussions and chats now on RCR with Winston Peters. Winston, welcome back. Nice to have you again.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, one word or is it two? News hub to start with.
This is a disaster for a number of reasons. There'll be a lot of conversation, discussion, but it was an impending disaster for some time because of the shape of a number of things, not the least of which was the changing shape of the New Zealand media, so to speak. But for personal reasons, for the staff and their families, their spouses, it's a disaster. But for our democracy, in terms of options, it also is a serious concern.
Though it could be argued that it wasn't adding much to the democracy anyway, maybe.
Well, you could say that because, frankly, there were sort of ominous warnings for some time. But that doesn't mean that we should not have first-rate alternative news outlets, all with a mission to report with neutrality exactly what's going on. That's the point. Just because you've got something that's not the model you should have in terms of performance, there's no reason why you should not aspire in a democracy for the right model, so to speak.
Yeah. You've been around a long time, don't need to remind you. But back in the day, I don't know, going back 20, 30 years, how different was it from your observation in terms of those media principles, journalistic principles that you've singled out recently that are totally lacking? Many of us would agree with that. What's the comparison like when you think back to those times, compare it with now?
Well, back then, particularly investigative journalism was given far more time and far more resources to do their job properly. And I progressively saw them being starved of this. I made a speech over 28 years ago saying that I could see something ominous shaping up in New Zealand. But, you know, people just think that you don't know what you're talking about and just ignore what you say. And I remember Maurice Williamson was the one that actually enabled TV3 to keep going a long time ago. Everybody forgets that. And so, how shall I say it? It's disappointing to get to where we are, to where we are now, and just find that you've got one television broadcasting potential future, which is taxpayer funded, up against those who were not, in the extent they may have been. To be fair,
what about? We found out this week that there'd been some collusion, let's say, amongst senior journalists, editors, seriously discussing not reporting you.
Well, you know, something, I was not surprised by that. There have been past times when they have met, and a long time ago, where the group agreement of the senior people was to treat me and my party as being risible. That was the word they used. It never worked then, but they were doing it sometimes back then. And they didn't in the last campaign as well. I mean, we had so many meetings where they never turned up. Now they're claiming that they did, but they didn't. I've got all the videos of all those meetings, and there wasn't one journalist there. And so it didn't surprise me, but what astonished me in this context was not that they did it, but that they thought that the Public Interest Journalism Fund was about neutrality. Why don't they actually read the terms of the contract? Anybody that reads the terms of that contract, including the caveat that if they didn't perform in the way that was requested of them in the contract, the money would be taken back off them, knows fully what I'm talking about. And I'm astounded that people at the very top of the media could stand there and Bareface claim it was otherwise, that black, in fact, is white.
They're not that dumb, are they?
Well, I thought myself, if you people are meeting, and I saw the editor of the Herald, to the listener have a go at me and others as well, and I thought, you must think that you're so clever and you're so esteemed and so above accountability that facts don't matter. Go back and read your contract. Well, didn't even read it the first time round. But I was there when we stopped it. They never got that contract until December 2020, a month after the 2020 election. That's my bona fides. What's theirs?
It seems in the aftermath of News Hub, because this is the big one that is happening right now, and it kind of follows on from what you're just saying there. There doesn't seem to be an appreciation amongst the people in the sector, let's say, about why they're in the situation they're in. It's like they don't kind of realize it. Is that what you pick up?
Well, that's the most disturbing feature, because I know too many serious journalists, experienced journalists, who know what I'm talking about. These people have gone on, and some of them have retired, but some of them are still involved in other sectors of the media, often privately funded, because of the state of things as they are. But the part that concerned me was, put aside that, you know, the Fourth Estate is not government, and it's not, how shall I say, a part and parcel of the governance of a administration of a country. It is the holding the administration to account that matters there. That they could be at that level and not understand their critical role and how they may have failed at it.
There was a hit piece on us and stuff just the last week, journalist Glenn McConnell, and he was insinuating that by, like, someone like you talking to us right now, that you're legitimizing extreme content because we are extreme.
Well, he's looking in the mirror. This is a lefty shill. This is somebody that came down to a meeting at Howick. It was wall to wall. I gave them a copy of my speech at the end of it, at the beginning of it, so they'd know what I was talking about. They had not one question to ask me about my speech. They came out to have a go at me about something else, and I thought, I'm not putting up with this. I've been around too long. This hall is packed out for a reason. We're making a comeback here, and you're staring it in the face, and you're so ignorant of your duty to report the rise and the increase of audience and support. It's called market share in politics, and you think you're going to get away with that? So I'm not concerned about his attack, although he had the audacity to actually write it, and worse still, somebody actually published it.
Yeah, I mean, in one day, a week ago, had Margaret Mutu on, followed by David Seymour. I mean, how can you say that's extreme?
Well, you're doing what Phil Collins did when he sang this song called Both Sides of the Story. That's what a journalist's job is to do, is to purport the fact and let the public decide. But no, we've got all these hardly trained, barely out of journalism school editorial writers in these days, and they think that passes for news. It doesn't. That's why there's been a massive fall-off. People will read the news if they believe that what they've got in the end is a chance to decide for themselves based on a mixed set of facts, all put out for them to be the decision-maker.
And isn't it the example that we can point to of how tragic this can be is the last 3 years, isn't it? Because that Fourth Estate was weaponized against New Zealanders, wasn't it?
Of course they were. It's in their contract. And Jacinda Ardern, when she was talking to, I think it was Joe Biden, explained to him how they did it. It's all in her own statement. And here's the tragedy, is that you've got senior people in the media, well, senior with inverted commas, who've got the temerity to try and argue this is all above board. No, it's not. It's $55 million of corruption and a bribe. And they're not going to turn me off saying it. They may not like it, but I put up with them gaslighting me, and I'm going to tell them. It's the quote and all saying, when they stop telling lies about me, I'll stop telling the truth about them.
TVNZ and RNZ, but TVNZ, let's say, government-owned, it's a SEO or SOE, yeah, right. So they've got to wash their face. That doesn't seem to be happening so much now. And they are also, they stand accused of this kind of, distortion of journalism. Seriously, are they required anymore? Are they serving the taxpayer? Do we need to be thinking about the relevance of them and their future now? Plenty of people are. That's why I'm asking.
I know they are, but if you go and look at the manifestos of political parties at the 2023 election, how many parties have a policy with respect to the fourth estate? To the critical need for there to be a fourth estate? Well, we did. We could see then that there was trouble coming, and we wrote in our manifesto what needed to be looked at. Because at the end of the day, I've always been a supporter, for example, of the BBC when it was going great, or the ABC when it was once going great, because it's actually the beginning of shaping as a voice an emerging culture, which is Australia in that case, or the UK in the first instance, or in our case, New Zealand. And they've lost that. They've lost this sense that, look, all our job is to do is to report what's going on. And as the influences carry on to the future, whether it be socially or politically, we'll be an independent voice to ensure that the truth is out there. That's what they've lost. So the romance and glamour of a great idea called the Fourth Estate, and it was phrased a long time ago in the UK Parliament when somebody rose to say what this was that was happening, and he called it the Fourth Estate. He gave it the name in the first place. And how much have they lost not understanding their true responsibilities? And what I've been teaching at journalism school, that's not the purpose of the whole idea.
Well, yeah, questions have to be asked about what's being taught there. Again, government-funded institutions. Can you have a broadcaster like TVNZ and like RNZ not just reporting the information in the way that we would expect, but trying to undermine, really, the decision-making of the New Zealand voter? Is that tolerable?
No, it's not. And that's their point. They've got a very short time to get themselves clearly in mind as to what their responsibilities are. Otherwise, there will be changes, and these changes are forced upon them, not by politics. Will be forced upon them by people exiting their viewership or listenership, and that's what's been happening.
I want to jump to what happened on, I think it was Friday morning, you went and met NZD, SOS, they were down at the Cenotaph. 2 years since that whole thing came to an end at Parliament. First of all, I think you and Tanya Unkevich were the only people to turn up, it seems. Good on you for doing that. It still seems like most MPs like to lurk behind the door and not come out still. Is that the case?
Well, I can't understand that because, when I came to Parliament, no matter who was down there, your job was to send someone down. You're all too busy, but you send someone down, depute somebody from your caucus and across the party lines to go down and hear them out. And that all stopped under COVID. And was even worse than that, they signed a pact, 120 members of Parliament, to virtually outlaw them. You had a speaker to turn the cold water on young people at night, who paid against the laws of this country, the noise abatement laws, loud music. All of that ended up being made an ambassador to Ireland. This is repugnant in the extreme, but that's what happened. And I can't talk for them MPs, but we're not going to let it happen, and that's why we went down to hear people who are talking about an inquiry which they want to be genuine and complete. So at the end of the day, when the inquiry's over, and the expenditure of the money is not a waste because it's something that we can rely upon to better, in the future, handle a similar problem that might arise. That's the purpose of this.
You were handed a letter, I think, by Dr. Matt Shelton. Can you tell us what that was about at all, or is that private, confidential, I suppose?
No. There's a petition to all parliamentarians, and I need to make sure they've all got it before I start talking about it.
Okay. On to this Commission of Inquiry and what we've been hearing from our listeners. There seems to be a lot of unhappiness about Commissioner Peter Blakely. Are you aware of that?
I'm more aware that about it than the other Member of Parliament. That's why I made a speech in Whangarei in the campaign saying what I wanted in terms of a proper inquiry. Terms of reference that were complete and comprehensive, and the commissioners capable of ensuring that those independent terms of reference were probably central to the inquiry. Now, does Mr. Blakely fulfill that requirement? The answer is profoundly no.
Yeah, okay. So what does that mean, essentially, for him?
Well, we'll have to wait and see developments. But if you go back on the statements he made and the role that he was playing, he cannot surely be imaged as neutral. And here's my real point, which I said at Whanganui Arrangements. Any commissioner that saw those terms of reference wanting a genuine outcome would have never taken the job in the first place. And I believe in the end, one didn't.
No, one bailed out. Yeah, the we know about that. So there's still a bit of water to go under the bridge, re-Blakely, is it fair to say?
It is. But here's the real point. You know, if I was in that position, and I'll tell you an example, when I became Minister of Foreign Affairs in 2017, a man walked into my office with a resignation in his hand. He knew the system. He knew what was required. Of course, I didn't accept the resignation, but at least he put it up to me, knowing that I had the right to ask for it.
Right.
As a matter of courtesy. His name was Don McKinnon. He's a serious parliamentarian. He went on to be the head of the Commonwealth. And after that job, he came in for the other job that he had, and he said to me, Winston, here's my resignation. Now, I was not surprised by it, because he knows how the system should work.
So you're saying...
I didn't accept the resignation.
No, but he furnished it. So you're saying you possibly would have expected the same ethical move regarding the person we're talking about now?
Well, when you see a commission of inquiry that's set up not to get to the truth, but to cover the government's derriere and its absence of critical parts of the inquiry in terms of its terms of reference, image that, that's the least I would have expected. But you see, these are, again, examples of standards that have dropped in this country, and we must get them back and get them back fast.
And are you secure that when it all comes out in the wash, that we will get what you're talking about and what we expect to get in terms of this inquiry, like you say?
Oh, I can't make that promise. What I can promise to do is try and get terms of reference and the people to ensure that that is the most likely outcome. You can never perceive what might happen in the future, but if you get the right people with the right terms of reference, I'm confident we'll get an outcome we can have trust in. I don't want people biased on either side of the argument. I want neutral people whose professionalism images their preparedness to hear all the facts and tell us exactly what went right and what went wrong. We all knew that when COVID arrived in 2020, we were staring down a prospect of the Spanish flu and all that disastrous outcome was for New Zealand. But when we started to know more, then we were not told at all. That's my point.
Yeah.
We had a sense of absolutism. We had non-scientific approaches being taken. We heard people saying things that they cannot live by now. And they were also arguing that they were the podium of truth. Now, nowhere in the world would you hear that sort of absolutism in a democracy.
That one was a stunner for sure. Your colleagues...
Well, you know, remember, yep. I might have Roosevelt's famous comments that he took up after the Great Depression in the United States. He said this, "We may not always get it right, but we'll keep on trying." That's all we expect of them, not insisting they'd always get it right.
Well, there was no humility in that, was there? The whole podium of truth thing. And your colleagues in New Zealand First accepted. Other colleagues in your coalition arrangement, are they aware that, I'm just suggesting that if this inquiry doesn't turn out to be what a lot of people hope it will be, the problem doesn't go away?
I agree with that. And we had a recent judicial finding with respect to mandating and the military in this country. You know, this is telling stuff. And barely one outfit carried it. I put it on my social media. It's up to 416 now. You don't get there because you're saying something that's wrong. It's there because people are concerned and share your concern. And you're quite right. But all I'm promising is what I said in Whangarei in public before the election. I promised to deliver that. And there are others who might say, but what about this, what about that? And I'm saying to them, look, if we do that, we might be here for another 10 years. Can we just restrict it to the things we made a commitment to and voted for and get it done professionally and independently?
Okay, your hat as Foreign Affairs Minister now, another $26 million in package of support for Ukraine. I think we're up to $100 million now. What's that money going to be used for, Winston?
It'll be used for a wide range of support for them on the ground, medical, all sorts of help, so to speak. Because what happens in the Ukraine will affect us. Anyone who thinks we live in isolation now on these matters is wrong. And this is a battle for freedom and democracy at this point in time.
But is it really?
And unrightful. Well, it was an invasion. Uncalled for, out of left field, claiming all sorts of excuses, which are not stacking up anymore. It's sad because I always hoped that following the fall of the Soviet Union, that we could help Russia become a great democracy. And maybe that was an aspiration, a dream, but for a while they were shaping up to be that way. Then all of a sudden it's dramatically changed, and for the worse.
Well, yeah, we could debate that one, but okay, $100 million.
Yeah, what we can't debate is that people are starving because they haven't got supplies of Ukraine food. These things have an overreach, and they have an extension going well around the world. All those are facts now.
So this is not military aid. Is it going to be accounted for? Will the New Zealand taxpayer know what this money has been spent on? Given that it could be up to 500,000 Ukrainian men have been through the meat grinder of war, and a lot of people don't feel comfortable with that at all.
Yes, but it's at their request and joined by the EU and all sorts of countries lined up.
Yeah, but the EU too are a bit demented on this one too. But will it be accounted for? Can we see where it's spent?
Let's begin the subject by realizing that nobody and no country is perfect, but we can keep on trying.
Yeah, well, when you've got your ally blowing up your own gas pipeline, it's pretty crazy. But I guess, okay, for humanitarian aid, absolutely understand that. But will there be accountability for this money? Because there seems to have been a lot of money pumped into Ukraine with no one knows where it's gone, who's spent it, who's benefited. Will we know?
Well, we'll know to the sense of and context that we've itemized and why we are doing it, and it is to ensure that they survive this invasion as a country and go on being independent. These are critical things, because if you let this go, then the ramifications, as are being felt all across Europe now, will be greater and greater. It's a concern. And are the agencies all perfect? No, they're not. But our job is to do the best we can to ensure that we can talk to the New Zealand people and say we did it for this reason.
All right. And the other sort of foreign policy matter, the designation of all arms of Hamas as a terrorist organization, it's been controversial. We've taken that step now. I'll just read you this quote from John Minto, if you don't mind. Hamas reiterates that its conflict is with the Zionist project and not with the Jews based on their religion. Hamas is not fighting against the Jews because they are Jews, but against the Zionists who are occupying Palestine. Hamas rejects the persecution of people or the undermining of their rights on nationalist, religious, or sectarian ground. Does that mean anything to you, what John Minto said there?
Put that alongside what happened on the 7th of October last year, and tell me, Mr. Minto, how do you explain that?
Okay, so what does that mean in terms of people who, because quite a few people are supporting, you know, liberation for Palestinians, Palestine, they want the separate state. There are some things with that designation, you can't display Hamas flags and things like that. What does it actually mean?
Well, it means that they're a terrorist organization, that aid for them will not be able to be provisioned through our normal system, so to speak, in the way it has been. But the reality is that we've got a catastrophe there developing in Gaza, and we are putting a huge effort into and trying to ensure that where we can, with the resources we've got, that we do help those innocent victims. And war also always has so many people who are the innocent collateral damage of such an approach. But that's what's going on. It's not anything other than our belief. And it always has been our belief that we want a permanent ceasefire, not a temporary one, a permanent ceasefire and a two-state solution. And that's what we're putting our efforts behind, and always have. And that was a view that we had across the political divide, not just the present government's view, but a previous government's view as well. And we've got to stick to, I believe, that, because that is the only long-term outcome that will be peaceful. But it's got to be, as Keir Starmer, the Labour leader in the UK, said, it's got to be a ceasefire that is permanent.
And back home, how do you think things have progressed since Waitangi Day? Is the anger down? Is the engagement up? Have we grown up a little in the conversation? Has the mood of the nation changed? What are your perceptions of that?
Where's all the anger coming from? It's coming from a group usually of elite Māori and their cultural fellow travellers who think that they can change the laws, not so much with the electoral mandate, never talked about it, did it all in secret, and saying to us basically, here's the Pandora's principle. Now, you try and fix this up because you can't. And the answer is, yes, we can, and we will. Out there, there are hundreds of thousands of ordinary Māori who are not a part of this protest. It's always the elite, always on the taxpayer's pocket, always living in a privileged position, arguing some sociological claptrap they learned at university, and none of it's aligned with the great leaders of Ngata, Pomare, Buck, or dare I say Carol, of a former time when there was greatness in the Māori leadership of this country.
Do you think we'll get to some sort of referendum? Do you think that'll go all the way? Treaty principles bill? Because I think it was the Prime Minister said that he'd only supported so far.
Well, that's his position, and that, of course, means that it's dead on the water, having gone to the Select Committee. Our position has been slightly different. We have said, well, first of all, we don't agree that there are principles, so we don't understand the bill. But you should be free to put it up in front of the country and have a free debate and see what the country thinks. Maybe, just maybe, something will emerge which will take the country forward. But if your premise is that the Treaty of Waitangi has been misdescribed and rewritten and tinkered with in extreme ways to make it seem like something it never was, and that it does not have any principles, this three-clause document, if that is your position, then it's very difficult to understand how this will go at the State Committee any further. However, one should always have an open mind just in case something might emerge that does have promise to resolve this matter, but it will not be based on recasting new principles. We'll have an academic argument that goes on for the next 20 years, unsoundly so, whilst the basic fundamentals that Māori and European and everybody else is screaming out for, decent affordable housing, access to health if you should fall ill, the escalators of education working for everybody, and first world incomes, those things will fall by the wayside while this detour or roadblock to progress goes on.
Right. And last question on gang patches, of all things. Can a country that claims to have free speech really tell people what to wear? I mean, I'm sure most of our listeners are intimidated by gang patches and gang regalia, but in the end, where does it cross the line of free speech, wearing a patch in public like that, do you think?
Where the wearing of that regalia is associated with crime after crime after crime, and in many cases, a certain terrorism, then the answer to that is yes. Happened in Western Australia, it's happened in Queensland. Why can't it happen here? And there was somebody in Parliament the other day from the other side making this breathing excuse saying, yeah, but in Western Australia, they just moved elsewhere. That's what they said. What they said by that statement was a good word there. And what we're saying to Māori and the gangs themselves, we're not going to tolerate this any longer. We want you to be part of society. We want you to contribute like everybody else. And the idea of terrorising your own people, and it's usually Māori who are the biggest victims, is going to stop.
It needs more measures, though, doesn't it? I mean, how about cracking down on financial activities and the actual, the day-to-day criminal offending? The two have to go hand in hand, don't they?
Well, of course. But it goes at all levels. I mean, don't just concentrate on the gangs, but concentrate on white-collar crime. Concentrate on the black economy. We know that this economy loses probably between $10 and $15 billion a year because of the black economy.
Yeah, but white-collar crime, they're not sitting on weapons, Winston, the white-collar criminals. They're not standing over people and beating the crap out of them, you know?
No, they're not. But if you see recently, with respect to immigration, the number of employers in this country, and it's sad that this ever happened, but it's actually inflicting slavery on their people. This is in a country called New Zealand, a democracy. This is a disgrace. So look at all areas, treat everything fairly. Crime is crime.
Okay, and how do you think it's been going, Winston? What's it been like? What's the ride been like so far for you?
It's funny to say that, but because of the late election and the 3 weeks born of the hopeless electoral system we've got in terms of the counting of the votes, and the 3 weeks delay and then Christmas has meant that this has been unlike any formation of government because we're flat out trying to catch up. And then there's so many vacuums that we inherited, that's really of great concern. Look at all the figures that have come out. And just to make sure that things were worse, socially, economically, and every other respect, they secretly, without any warning, the previous government, by December of last year, had brought in 148,000 or 132,000 net. So all the demands we'll need in terms of infrastructure, housing, and health, and education, all those things have just been massively exacerbated. And is the mainstream media talking about the wrongness of that or the unpreparedness or unheralded notice of that? Nothing at all. That's why we're in trouble here, trying to fix this, when you've got so many people who know better who barely ask the question. How many people in the mainstream media have pointed out what are the consequences of bringing in net 132,000 unparalleled anywhere in the world for a country of our size? What is the net consequence of that?
Unless you're trying to do damage.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's obvious, isn't it, that the consequences of what you've just described. So why would you push your head unless you kind of, okay, didn't care too much about the damage it might do to per capita income, individual wealth, individual circumstances, etc.?
Well, it's almost like the previous government knew that the game was up and they thought they'd leave us an impossible task. And you could come to that conclusion, but there's no other conclusion. It wasn't planned, it wasn't structured, it wasn't heralded. They didn't tell anybody in the media. Below it is the media are of them. So how come this happened? But it did.
Wow. All right, good to catch up with you again, Winston. Thanks for giving us a bit of time this morning. It's great.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and I hope you don't get too much blame for having me on.
Yeah, it's another extremist on.
Oh, dear. Well, you know something. There's an old saying, actually Winston Churchill has said this, the trouble being on the side of right is you keep so much dubious company. So keep faith and carry on.
Yep, we will. We'll talk again soon, hopefully. Thank you.
Okay, cheers and bye-bye.
RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.